And we're live with our 300th episode of Absolute AppSec. 300 episodes. I'm Ken Johnson at CK Tricky on social media, joined by my co-host Seth Law at Seth Law on social media. Seth, say hi.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to episode number 300. So excited to be here. Feels like a bit of a milestone for us. We've been doing this for a number of years at this point. Ebbs and flows, definitely. As with everything else in life, as we get busy, as we do other things. But yeah, excited that after so many years, we're still going, right? Appreciate Ken's, support and all the other support, everybody that's been on the show. So I'm excited to go for 300 more, I guess, right? May as well. Feels like things are changing, but the more things change, the more they stay the same over and over and over. The topics that we discuss, the Crocs and socks of security. And I don't think it is going to, there's always going to be something to talk about, I guess I should say. Always. I know it's been AI the last year, but before that we had Web3, before that we had mobile, before that we had, take your pick, right? And we're gonna reminisce a little bit today on some of the things that we've talked about over the years, what we've seen change over the last 300 episodes, 6-7 years, what we're expecting for the future. I know we typically do an end of the year, beginning of the year, type of retrospective, but I think this will be a longer term one on some of the things that we find great about the industry and some of the things that maybe not so great. But with that, before we dive in, I did want to promote training really quick. Training.absoluteappsec.com. We have a few courses that are listed there, or I think there's two that are live that you can register for at the moment. The first one will be Harnessing LLMs for Application Security. This one is a virtual course that will be taught November 20th and 21st. It is a go. So we have a few seats available still. Would love to have you. There has been interest. We've been asked to redo this one, especially after we taught it at DEF CON and a few other places. And this is the second time that we've run it as a virtual course. This one changes quite a bit from month to month, just based on what we're actually doing with LLMs and what we're seeing and prompt engineering and new models and effective use and agents and MCP. So there's going to be some new additions to that, I'm sure. Or I know there will be, right? Whether that's like use of MCP servers for agents, how we're actually utilizing some of that. I've got some, especially on the dynamic side, the use of MCP and agents is fairly required for things like dynamic tests and whatever else. So there's that one. There's the Europe, I think it's Next Gen Secure Code Review, which is a combination of Secure Code Review and Harnessing LLMs. This is the Black Hat course that we're going to be doing a deep dive into basically building out agents to do secure code review and other AppSec tasks, but focused on learning the secure code review methodology and how to implement that using LLMs. And then I guess we can announce as well that we will be picked up for Black Hat Asia. We'll be doing that same course there, as well as at KernelCon next year. This last year, we didn't go to KernelCon. We've done practical secure code review there in prior years or previous years. But this year, we will be doing Harnessing LLMs for Application Security. We're shifting the training course, and pretty soon we'll have an online version of practical secure code review. Anyway, I'm talking a lot, Ken. Right? What are you looking forward to as far as the training goes? What is it that you would like to highlight there?
Oh, well, I was mostly just happy that the people that asked for the October one couldn't sign up in time and had to push out to November. I really freaking needed a break between our DEF CON course and the next virtual course. So I don't know. I'm grateful that it actually was extended out another month to let more people sign up, plus let those people actually get the time they needed to sign up. So I'm excited about that selfishly. Then of course, like London. Yeah. I mean, that's going to be really, really fun. It's a 4-day course because I always feel like we shovel everything in as much as we can in 2 days. It's a bit much. It's so, like we do what we can, but it's a lot of information. So 4 days is like, I feel like we just, that's what we really need is a 4-day format. So I'm excited about that. Beyond that, I don't know, man, like it's just sort of, you know, Q4, like let's, you've got your Q4 consulting services, concerns. I have mine, obviously. Yeah, we live and die by quarters. So Q4, yeah, that's just trying to hang on for dear life. But realistically, I think part of what makes that harder too is like post Thanksgiving, everybody slows down. And then when you're a service company, it's probably like, or not probably, I mean, I've experienced this too, where it's like, well, you're still doing your work, but you know, most of the time clients start to kind of get a bit more quiet. You're still finishing out the things you've got to do, but you're kind of wrapping up basically for the year and getting ready to look at like, okay, we got to start thinking about how are we going to get pipeline for Q1 kind of thing, right? Whereas like on the product side, I'm sitting here like, dude, it's going to be hard to get any sales through the pipeline after Thanksgiving in the US.
After just Thanksgiving. Yep, it is. Yeah.
So, at least for the US-based clients, it's going to be pretty tough. So, I don't know. That's always an extra challenge on top of it. It's like rush, 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 but understand that you have even less. It's like kind of like almost cutting the quarter and a half. So, you know, there's challenges.
Well, and I think that's why it happens, at least on the services side, is that everybody wants to do a quarter's worth of work, but they want to do it before the holidays hit. And so, you know, if you find a critical vulnerability in mid-December, the developers are going to hate you, right? Like that, like, let's be honest, you know, because it means they're going to have to come in, they're going to have to patch stuff. They're going to, you know, even though like you're saving them or whatever, it still is an issue. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting being on the other side of that too, by the way. It was like I've been on the other side of it, but not in the capacity, like as the liaison from the security team, not from like, you know, I run the company and I also need to like make sure that we, you know, are secure and that we follow our policies in terms of remediation and documentation and ticket tracking and everything else that goes into something like that. And it's actually like interesting to be on the other side of it. But anyways, I just want to say out loud, 300 episodes. We did it. We got to 300 freaking episodes, Seth. Like,
yeah,
we've run virtual conferences. We've done After Dark episodes. We've done random videos, we've done training. And on top of all that, we managed to still, on top of all of that, produce 300 episodes. And I think we started this right when I had joined GitHub, like not too long after GitHub. We started it probably within, I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. You had joined GitHub because it was, you know, we started 2018, right? Like I think that first couple of weeks of 2018, like you had just started GitHub. I had actually just started Redpoint as a company, right? We were coming off the other agency or company that shall not be named. And things have changed quite a bit, right?
I spent 6 years at GitHub and then pivoted off, and I've been almost 3 years at Dryrun. So like,
geez, yeah.
Yes, that's changed.
Really? Has it been that long? Damn.
It's been that long. It's wild. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This podcast probably carried me through 4.5-5 years at GitHub, roughly. And then like almost a few. So that's how long we've been doing it. That's how much has changed. You know, I know we're gonna talk about some of the things that were sort of the focus back in 2017, 2018, et cetera. And then like what's changed between now and then, but just taking a step back for a second and just saying like, holy cow, that is a lot of episodes. We've changed a lot in our careers and our like lives. No, man, it's just, you know, when I look at pictures of you from back then, you're the one who like, visually, like you have changed. Quite a bit.
What?
Kind of like a baby in comparison to Oh, you know,
I know it does. That's what I was going to do, is I was going to pick up like, yeah, one of those episodes and actually see. And also, like, we've gotten a little bit better with like production value and other things, right? Like, you know, where is it? Oh, it flips back and forth. Yeah. Anyway, yes. I was wondering if I was going to pull up a picture or something like that, but I don't think I'm going to do that. My ego doesn't need that hit right now.
Well, think about it this way. When we started, your youngest and my only were about 5 years old, I think, at that time, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Something like that. Now they're about to go into high school, right?
Mm-hmm. I guess that's true. Yeah.
So
yeah, they were
say that out loud of what's all changed.
Our personal life.
You have two now.
Now they're my size, right? Yeah.
Out of college and into college. Yeah.
Yeah. I have one that's graduated from college. Yeah. No. The older one's done.
Yeah.
The younger one, he's in his second year, right? So now he's got a college girlfriend and he knows everything. So yeah, you know how that is.
Oh, totally.
Yeah, it's crazy, right? Like, I mean, but it's been a good thing. I think about the community that we've built, right? Or that has kind of come together around the podcast and the events that we've done and the contributions and getting to know, honestly, people that we never would have met without actually just putting ourselves out there and talking about security has been one of the most satisfying things, right? And I get like people will listen to the podcast for a while and then will fade, or we get like new people in all the time and then they, you know, they'll engage, and then as life gets busy or they focus in on other things, then they stop being as prolific, or they, you know, they may not comment quite as much, but it still is this like continual renewal of interest, which I find great, right?
And we've met all these great people. I mean, we've been able to, like, if you think about it too, like, the podcast community has also helped enable us to get to the locations, you know, not just in the US, but outside the US too, to meet people that are active contributors and listeners to the podcast. And so what's funny is, to your point about the community now, like, I get questions and I tell people a lot of times my response now is like, you should probably just ask our Slack community, because they're going to know more than I am. They have a wider base of people to respond to. And that's actually one of the most useful things. Like one of the team members I have, who has been amazingly impactful for our capabilities, I met through the podcast, right? I mean, I have connected people. I mean, we've connected people to employers and employees. We've been able to help people further their careers. I know that we've had opportunities to bring people on who were doing interesting things and were kind of in that point in their career where they needed, or it's good for them to have a platform for where they can kind of talk about their research, but also, you know, sort of be more visible to the community. So I feel like we've been, and there's lots of other things we've done. We've given away. So, you know, the community has given a ton to us. We've tried to give back. We've given away, obviously, swag. We've given away, happy hours and events, and put on some both virtual and in-person things. And it's just been really a reciprocal sort of like very cool thing where the community helps us, we help the community, and that ends up helping, I hope, everybody out universally. So that's really been neat to just,
very
fun. So we've gotten some people on the podcast as guests who I'm just like, amazing, right? Like, people always think too, like it's going to be a big name, right? Yeah, we've had
James Kettle,
and Dave Eisler. We've had a lot of those folks, but sometimes it's like a Pedram, right? Who came on from Second, who I, it's like, privately knowing that person and just getting to interact, you're like, man, this is somebody I'm really happy that has come into my life and network and things like that. And so you just get to meet people that you just really maybe would never have had the opportunity before. And then always good things come to that. So yeah, mm-hmm. It's been really in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, as much as I would, you know, I start looking at the list and I want to give shout outs to people and, you know, we don't want to make this whole episode just like thank yous, right? So, but, you know, realistically, if you're listening, thank you. Thanks for supporting us. Thanks for, yeah, being a member of the community and invite others to come in, like, and learn about application security and get involved, because that's how we grow. Not necessarily just like Absolute AppSec and our community, but just security in general and AppSec in general. And, you know, at this point, it's like what AI or AISec? I don't know. Yeah. But it's still application security. They're all applications at some level. So cool. Well, one of the ideas that we had for this podcast and this episode specifically was to call back to some of the things that have happened over the last, you know, since we started. And, you know, 6 years, 8 years, whatever that actually is. But I don't know, like, I know you, Ken, you had like this list and, let's see, where is that at? I'm looking right now.
In our,
yeah.
Yeah.
Memorable battles or like, you know, things that have happened, you know, I you know, we've talked about the people, like we've talked about what's happened, like with the people that we've had on, the interesting, you know, relationships that we've actually made through the podcast. But let's take it back to like security in general. If we think back to the beginning of the podcast, what do you feel like has been kind of the most impactful? I was going to say technology, but I don't want to go there. Like what's been the most impactful, like basic thing that has changed for us since starting to talk more publicly about application security? I know it's a broad question, but I just want you to go wherever you kind of feel.
I'm just going to riff because I don't know. I don't have like a good answer prepared, but I think that's a really good question. I don't think the technology aspect is so interesting. I think, like one thing that I guess I'm thinking back to, like what was 2017 to 2019 looking like? Obviously, post 2020, everything kind of changed, but
yeah,
back in those days, I think, if I'm being candid, I think a lot of people were trying to emulate programs that were coming out of like, I don't know, maybe Silicon Valley, modern, like hip kind of security programs, like bleeding edge security programs where the culture's, you know, light and fluffy and really awesome. And everybody is, you know, super kind and generous and empathetic and all that good stuff. And we're kind of like shining examples. And at that time, everybody was trying to sort of replicate. Like, I can't tell you how many, no, I can't, right? We can say that there was like, every talk was sort of like developer empathy and you should, here's how to do security at scale with like, you know, the Netflix style approach,
paved right? Paths. Yep.
Paved paths and white glove, everything that's not on a paved path and yada, yada, yada. And so I think there was a lot of like, we should try to be like that. What I've seen since then is the recognition that no, there's a lot of different types of cultures. There's a lot of different types of considerations. Since then, you know, it's obviously come, people have been, and you only really get this information if you go to conferences and you talk to people who were in those places at that time. And then you, and I'll explain more what I mean here in a second, but you get to the hallway con part of things, the private conversations, the conversations that aren't held, you know, for the public to hear. And time goes on and you find out, well, there were some of that's true. Don't get me wrong. I'm not like saying these were people got up and spoke at conferences and told lies. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying there was some like with maybe too kind of an eye retrospective on things, or maybe some parts of these programs didn't really fester long enough to sort of have the pros and cons at over a period of time to, like, surface, right? So this is my nice saying, yeah, some of that stuff was not really all that, like, true to how it was discussed. People started to realize, like, okay, well, there are some parts of that that work for me, some parts that don't work for me. And I think now what I see is when I talk to people in security, there's just, it's more of like a real focus on the fundamentals, back to the fundamentals kind of discussions that I have these days. Even with AI coming into the mixture, I actually think, like, I almost feel like people are more concerned with the nuts and bolts of managing a program more than ever because of that. I don't have any enlightening information as to why, but that's what it feels like.
I think back 20, you know, pre-pandemic, like as we started the podcast, and I look over the topics that we actually jumped into, like security programs, champions, transitioning from developers to AppSec, building an AppSec program from scratch, right? Like we had Manico on talking about the one true framework, right? Like everything kind of points to hipster languages and frameworks, right? Like it points to this idea that, hey, we were very developer focused and we still are, but this idea of shifting left, right? Like that was the big, or one of the big topics is we're going to shift left, right? Like we're going to introduce security earlier on in the SDLC, and that's going to make huge waves. We're going to create all these paved paths. We're going to follow the Netflix model. We've got people to throw at this and extra money. And that's where we're going to guide our programs. And I don't think it's necessarily gone that way, right? Like it kind of turned into this myth, to your point, that, hey, it works. And it works at scale when you have a large enough team. But trying to apply the Netflix model at a startup, not such a good idea, right? Like it doesn't take into account like resourcing. It doesn't take into account upper management. It doesn't take into account like the environment that you're building these applications in or the target market compliance needs. It's just that we put on those rose-colored glasses. And I know even when we had Jim Manico on talking about the One True Framework, I remember being very skeptical about that yes, it's great to have like to build like this paved path that will eliminate all these classes of vulnerabilities. And that is a great target. That's a great goal to have, to work with the framework developers to build that. But we still see vulnerabilities that get introduced. We still see developers that are coming in new to the industry that don't necessarily have that experience, that they don't get the training, that they don't get other things. And so it's not a one size fits all. And I don't think anybody was claiming that it would be one size fits all, but those talks, to your point, were absolutely so well attended, right? Everybody was in there taking notes about, oh, this is how I like build a security champions programs. And I think that's one of the programs that I don't see as much need or as much, not necessarily need, but I don't see as much focus around anymore. When I come in and I talk with development programs and, security leads, security engineers and organizations, they're not asking about building a security champions program any longer. There's still a few, but nowadays they are more focused on other needs. And maybe that's just like the ebbs and flows, but I don't know, like you guys built a fairly decent security champions program at GitHub, if I remember right.
Yeah, it was, I think Tanya talked about, was it Tanya who talked about this? I think it was her who had said that these security champion programs, as they were promoted in all the conference talks and whatnot. I think and I'm sorry if I misquote you, Tanya, but I could have swore you basically said that people didn't have enough information and kind of went out and just said, we're going to do a security champion program. And there were a lot of like learnings that had come along the way of running these for a few years. you know, it's been popular now at least for about a decade almost, that this has been a concept that's been pretty popular, I think. You maybe needed that long to see, you know, the good and the bad, maybe 5 years, even half that time. But I think we pretty quickly into that saw people just kind of not know that they had some stipulations and ways to run that needed to be put into place. It needed to be managed very tightly. There needed to be, you know, a lot of things. So, you know, everything from metrics and things like KPIs, right? Are you meeting your, that being baked into their performance reviews, for instance, like security, the security function being, giving them goals that are security specific metrics that they have to meet that are also then baked into performance goals. And there's many, many other things beyond that. It's the way that you train them. What tasks are you having them do? What are the expectations? How is communication happening? There's a lot of things, a lot of devil in the details type things. And people didn't do that. They didn't have that knowledge. And who's to say if the people touting those security champion programs also had enough time to let it, again, sort of just marinate and see what falls out and what they need to warn people about and give us cautionary tales. I don't think security champions in like totality as a concept has failed, but I think we did see that fall out of favor because, like I said, basically a lot of people tried it. They didn't really know the proper ways to run one. Maybe even the people suggesting it also didn't even know how to recommend what to do, right? To run a proper program. And I think that skewed that whole thing is what it seems like. And there are still very effective security champion programs. So yeah. I can't say it's a wash, but I can say that there's reasons why it's not as popular.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. So there's security champions programs. The other one that you did bring up that I wanted to talk about specifically is bug bounty programs.
Oh yeah.
Because that was the other really big kind of thing that was happening. And it still is, to be honest, right? Like bug bounty is still a huge market. There are a lot of people that are in that space. There's a lot of great talent that's involved there. There's vulnerabilities that are found. Security issues are reduced because of bug bounty programs. However, it's not, again, like the security champions programs, it's not a one-size-fits-all solution. And not having the proper infrastructure internal to an organization to actually deal with bug bounty makes for a really bad experience, both for the bounty researchers and for the developers themselves. There is just a barrier to entry when you're trying to run one of those programs that may not be in place, depending on your size, depending on your organization. And it felt like everyone wanted to do a bug bounty program back, you know, 2019, 2018 timeframe. We were helping startups that, you know, basically have like three or four engineers trying to run bug bounty programs. And you know, just realizing that the amount of effort and time and cost that goes into it weren't necessarily effective. So it's not that they've fallen out of favor, but I feel like we better understand the needs to go into running that sort of a program nowadays than we did back then. Again, we go in with rose-colored glasses that, hey, this is going to fix everything. And I feel like this is a repeatable process or behavior in the organization, right, with the hype cycles that we go through. So what are your feelings on bug bounty, right? When is it appropriate? When isn't it? And when would you actually recommend it? I mean, I know you're internal to an organization, a startup now, but you at GitHub specifically ran a very, very successful bug bounty program. In terms of what I have seen across the industry and other organizations, that is one of the most effective bug bounty programs that I've seen. But it took a lot of support from internal, from management, from engineers on your side to actually make that happen.
Yeah, I'd actually say that I didn't do much, frankly. I was involved. Let me put it this way. What I'm saying is that while I was involved and worked heavily with bug bounty, I'm in no way responsible for the good, the positive things that GitHub did to run that program. So like Jill Monet Carallo, for instance, she came from running, I think, 8 years of Apple's bug bounty. She's no longer at GitHub, but we got it off the ground. And I give Greg Osa a lot of credit too. Like Greg Osa set up a really nice program from the very, very get-go. But really, Jill and that team took it to the next set of, you know, the big level. We did some HackerOne events, and we had like, you know, HackerOne filters for keywords, and had a triage process. And yeah, I think we were very, very, we were very careful with how we communicated, just to make sure that the researchers understood where we were coming from. Everybody felt like they were valued, things of that nature. I'm just saying that to be like, yes, I participated in it, but please, I don't deserve any credit. Like there were much better, smarter, more involved people that did that. But what I can say is you should be thinking about a bug bounty program only if you're doing like, if you're not doing the things that like say a SOC 2 already, like across the board, not just saying that you do it, but actually not, if you're not doing it, you don't need a bug bounty program yet. Right. But once you have your program, like to me, this is true, not just a bug bounties, but anything that is like not a, I guess you would say somewhat reactionary. Like if you think about bug bounties, that's more of a proactive thing, right? That's me saying, in addition to what I already do, I want a more proactive approach where I communicate with hackers and they try to break into my stuff. And sometimes that means I run a private program where I take the best people from that public program, create a little VIP thing. And then as I release features, I'm going to have them test those features, right? Like that's to me always been one of the most helpful parts is before something goes general availability to have those eyes on it. And not just those eyes, but the eyes of the best people who only submit quality findings to you. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. Guess what? To get to that point where you can actually be proactive, that means you can't be treading water. And most people are treading water. Like that's what it seems like. Most people are reactionary. They are dealing with the alerts from their whatever DAST, SAST, whatever tool. They're dealing with pings from developers, questions about XYZ. They're trying to manage their security reviews. They're trying to help guide threat modeling in some other area. You know, a bunch of other things they're trying to do. They're like both reactive and in some cases edging towards proactive. But only like once you can safely say to yourself, I have a team that can like, I'm not going to be like, unless there's an actual like big fire today, which there shouldn't be that many big fires, I will have the ability and space in the day to do proactive things.
Yeah.
And once you get to that point, I feel like that's a great time to roll bug bounty out. I think bug bounty is changing too. Just like, cause I was curious about this, by the way. So I looked at some forums, like, you know, different Reddit threads and just different people in the bug bounty spaces talking about it. And what they say is that the bug bounty programs themselves, like companies are, for the most part, they're keeping them. But what you're seeing is an exit of the pros and an influx of the skiddies. And especially with AI, now you have these skiddies able to use, and sorry, I should say, script kiddies for anybody who's not old like Seth and I. That's what we call you if you're just a script and don't. Yeah, skiddies.
Skiddies.
So yeah, you got your skiddies with their AI powered tools or whatever. It doesn't have to be AI powered. And I guess this is not me saying, this is what I'm reading on the forums, that they're saying there's an influx of these folks. And so basically quality people are exiting these programs. Lower quality people are entering in mass. And that is hurting programs, not the people themselves. So
yeah, there's a lot of considerations with bug bounty programs that we didn't take into account as we were trying to launch these, right? Especially talking to some companies and helping run smaller bug bounty programs and realizing the amount of not only money that you need to put into it so that you can pay researchers appropriately, which I know, like, you know, Jason Haddix talks about all the time on, like, he's very involved with the bug bounty community and he's very empathetic and sympathetic to those people putting in the time, learning, identifying things, and then not being paid appropriately, right? you know, identifying. But then there, you know, on the flip side, having seen it from the startup perspective on the quality of those reports that come in, especially on some of those public programs, man, it's pretty rough, right? It can be pretty rough. And so it's hard to find those diamonds in the rough and work with the researchers if you don't have the time and you can't be proactive about curating that program in an appropriate manner. And so what you end up with is a lot of those skiddy style vulnerabilities where they just go run subfinder. They just, you know, they identify some things, and some of those issues are completely valid. But the, you know, the cost to vulnerability ratio and everything else that goes into it becomes kind of this difficult line to walk. So I still think it's an effective thing to do, but to your point, like being proactive and having the proper support is the key to making it work. Without it, you're just never going to get there. Yeah.
I'm going to add to what you just said and say it's even harder because there's also now situations where when you combine, what have we learned through the podcast and through like Jerry Gamblin and our discussions with guests and stuff, right? It's like the CVE landscape is a bit of a mess, and that's me. Yeah. They're working on it, but it's
that's being mess. Kind. Yeah.
Being kind. Okay. And we have a mutual friend. He probably vented to you the way he vented to me, who was like, listen, I run a bug bounty program, and I also have customers who use our product who sign legal agreements. When the customer who signed the legal agreement tells me about something and says it's a security vulnerability, and I say, no, that's a configurable option. So here's XYZ, why this is not a security issue. Like, clear as day. Paying customer who's like signed a contract, right? Then goes and submits a bug bounty, doesn't get the response they want through the bug bounty, then just goes and opens a CVE. And here's what I learned, because I was curious, why can you open a CVE with something and it stick doesn't meet, it's clearly, it doesn't have any technical details. There's no information. There's literally nothing. There's just, I think that there's a vulnerability in this platform, and it points to like a very broad, we'll just say authorization. I don't really remember what it was. Anyways. So then I looked into this and I was, you know, gone back and forth with this person a bunch, not the researcher, obviously, but our mutual friend. And when I looked into it, what I realized is that you can just submit a CVE with no technical details. It will be accepted. And then, the only time you have to defend it is when you actually get called on the carpet. But even then, mm-hmm. It is quite a process for the company. And that's kind of why they want you to be a CNA. That's what they'll start telling you to do. Well, if you want this problem to go away, just be a CNA. No biggie anymore. It's like, yeah. So let me get this straight. So anybody off the street can make up something completely lie, fabricate, submit a CVE, you'll accept it. And the only way I can take that down, even to be accepted, like I said, you don't need technical. And if somebody refutes, you still don't have to provide technical details at that point. It's only at the point where there becomes sort of like enough argument between all three entities, like that MITRE and the two, you know, the researcher and the company, well, then they maybe do an investigation, but they're going to make that really painful if they ever will even remove that. And then the answer will be, well, again, you could be a CNA and make this go away, which is just, mm-hmm. All right. So I'm just saying, they have like added on, there's like add-on effects that can occur. That's a bug bounties, but that is sort of the, I don't know. I see the world of CVEs and bug bounties and just everything that's going on, and it's all very, very chaotic.
It is chaotic. And there's a lot of like, I don't know, this goes back again, it's going to date me, but this goes back to RFP's discussion on vulnerability disclosure years and years ago. Right. Like, how do you actually disclose a vulnerability in a responsible manner? Have a company actually take care of it. Bug bounty has helped that way. The CVE process, right? Like exactly what you're saying is why I question when people put CVEs on their resume, right? Like, oh, I have all these CVEs. I'm like, great. So you filled out a form, right? Like, you know, when it's been accepted or the CVE is pushed out by Apple or one of the CNAs, right? Like, okay, maybe there's some more credit that's due there, but take that with a grain of salt in, you know, if you are looking at resumes and hiring someone based upon their CVE number and what they've actually done.
Yeah, we get them to explain the whole like process of getting their CV accepted and the technical detail. Because yeah, you're right. It's I did not know that, by the way. Like I knew there was I've heard the complaint, I've heard some complaints, I've heard all, but it wasn't until I was like, whoa, that's where we're at. As it's just they are so I would assume underwater or whatever that they're just like, look, if someone submits, we're not even gonna look at it. Just it's accepted. Like, what? What? Well, they look at it for the submission information being complete, not like the is technically, and I get that, right? Like it's but at the same time, it's like I did not realize that it could just be accepted and made a CV without like the other comp, the person, the product or the company that it was submitted against having a chance to say something before it's cut and like
confirm. Yeah. Yep. At least confirm that it's realistic.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because now if you're an internal defender, what happens now? Every single time you talk to a customer, or even if you're not talking to them, they're going to be reaching out to you saying, hey, you have a CV in this, when are you going to fix this? You're like, like there is no CV, but now I have to talk to people about this. Cause anyways, a little bit of a mess is all I'm saying. So
yeah.
Bug bounties have been interesting one as well. I'll just say.
Yes. That. Okay. So we have bug bounties, you know, we've talked about security champions. On the flip side of that, what has surprised you in a good way? Right. Like what has come about? Like if you're thinking 2017 to 2019, what we were doing, what we were talking about, like we, you know, the whole shift left, you know, training security champions, bug bounty, like for identifying vulnerabilities. Is there anything in there that's actually done as expected, right? Like done well or done better, or came out of left field that you did not expect to actually take off?
I do feel like the security community has kind of gotten a little bit more savvy in a lot of ways, like in a sense of, all right, you see now a lot of conversations are about, all right, I'm going to split this up in a few different ways. So like I've seen an evolution, and what I've seen is, and just pointing to some different data points, we'll say that show evolution. Well, from a across the board, let's just talk about vendors, for instance. There's been a big push lately to unify tooling and get rid of, one-off tools, and to try and make it an ecosystem that kind of like we did joke about this last week though, but this is like always a topic every year, it feels like, but I have noticed a concerted effort to say like, hey, we have a lot of these different point solutions out here. We need to start thinking about how to like get all of our data into a spot so that we can sort of optimize how we use that data and manage our program. I've seen more focus on metrics and ROI as a whole, trying to put some numbers to why we have value and being aware that we have the opportunity to be in some cases a sales center or not totally just a cost, but like, so for instance, doing some pre-sales engineering, for example, or if you can reflect XYZ that maybe helps enable a sale, for instance, like I think people are really coming to that understanding that we are just like everybody else, a department, we have value. We need to show that value. How do we show that value? How do we basically be grownups? And that's been really neat to see. I think that's just evolved over time is like, yeah, folks being a bit more focused on that. I've noticed some, again, talking about being a bit more wise, a bit pickier where to spend money. I've noticed that, and we had Fergie on who talked about this. Sometimes training makes sense, right? Sometimes training makes sense, and sometimes a specific training platform makes sense. But I think we had for a long time just said, well, if we put training, generic training, even if it's really like no longer a CBT with like the SCORM compliant XML, right? So something that's actually got code in it, something that you can interactively like, here's the right fix for that vulnerable code, thinking like secure code were, for example, back then. You know, that was always sort of like the solution, and people are now more wise to, yes, training can be effective, but it has to be effective in the right ways for the right purpose at the right time with the right folks. And the content has to make sense and it needs to be more applicable to our specific environment. So I've seen just people get more wise in that way. I think like I could keep showing different data points or different examples, but it does feel like these days we are almost demanding of ourselves to standardize things, to be more of a business unit and reflect that in our work, rather than we're a bunch of hackers. Now we're paid professionally to like do that for you internally. And like, let's help make sure you're, you know, code secure. It's like as AppSec practitioners, that's a great mandate, but that's not all that matters. And we've woken up.
Yeah.
What about you? Yeah. What do you think has improved, gotten worse, gotten better? You know,
one of the things that actually surprised me was the adoption of threat modeling as a process, right? And the evolution that's happened with threat modeling in general, right? So we've got like Mozilla's rapid risk assessment that, you know, kind of took off as a threat modeling activity. You got what Jeevan Singh did and his presentations that actually fed into it. Whereas it was such like a huge kind of monolithic activity. If you look at Stride, you look at Dread, the Pasta, like the huge like frameworks that we came up with on this is how you do threat modeling that were so prescriptive and so kind of overbearing, right? But what's actually happened is this more nimble discussion on threats for an application. Yes, like we've taken these kind of good bits out of those large frameworks and applied them appropriately. And we've started to have developers recognize this. I've had more interactions with developers asking about threats for things like, you know, SSO and SAML and OAuth flows, like, you know, that are coming to me with already having done something along those lines, even if it's not the huge prescriptive thing, but it's a couple of lines of, well, we recognize that this could be a problem, so we wanted to talk to the security team about it first, right? And so this idea that a threat model isn't this big monolithic process that runs during the SDLC, but it's this point in time assessment of what is it that I'm doing and what are the threats that exist and how that's actually gone out to the developer community, at least in my circles, has been a bit of a surprise to me. It's been a good thing, right? But it's been a little bit of a surprise to me because I didn't expect that to happen.
Yeah,
I think about it. Yeah.
Process large and you don't do what you said, which is pick from the different model methodologies and like try to make a lighter weight one. It's like, how do you ever expect that to be something that developers are ever going to not even just have the capability to do, but even actually just do if you don't keep it like lightweight and flexible?
Yep. And so that's been a good thing. The other thing I wanted to bring up is what Larry was mentioning in Slack was platform consolidation from point solutions into, you know, platforms that actually do application security or security things, right? There's always hundreds of vendors, right, across the board. But what we've seen is this evolution of, hey, we've got like, an SCA tool that they've built that's looking for, you know, out-of-date dependencies. Now that has evolved to, oh, we're pulling in results and it's more PM, right? Like we're pulling all of these different point solutions together into a platform that can actually be usable and is presentable to the developers at large, right? That's not necessarily something I was expecting to see, but it makes sense with the evolution of the evolution of application security in general and how we have grown up as an industry. We have to be able to show those metrics to your point. We're becoming more of a business process. We're becoming more integrated into the overall development lifecycle. And part of that is actually showing that value and presenting results in a way that can be consumed by the not only the developers, but by business in general.
Yeah. And when you think about it, the economy has been pretty rough since 2020. We had probably 2021, maybe late. I can't remember the exact point if it was like late 2021 or just beginning of 2022. But, you know, everybody had done during COVID, they did all the ramp up, like, you know, 60, 70% headcount growth, whatever, all these companies. And then obviously, and then supply chain issues. So when you factor all of the overdoing it on hiring and all the spending and all the at the same time, other conditions of supply chain, it put us in at least the last few years, you know, the whole world, but, you know, especially we're US based, the US has been really, really tough. And I wonder if that didn't play a part in forcing people's hands to consolidate on solutions, consolidate on vendors, streamline operations, show KPIs and metrics and ROI, et cetera, you know, better. And do what you're saying, which is just like focus on being a good, solid part of the business and reflecting that. I just wonder if, you know, like there aren't many factors going on here, besides just time, right? It's like OWASP's been around for, I think, like 25 years now. And like, it's definitely grown and changed, but I personally feel like I've seen more change over this last decade than I have previous, you know, especially the last like 5 years. I've seen a lot of changes, maybe 5-6 years versus the previous 20. But I don't know if you feel the same.
No, I do, right? Like it definitely has ramped up. And I know we talk a lot on the podcast about AI and how it's affecting and us as an industry. I don't want to dig into that too much right now, right? Like we have definitely talked about that. And so it's more interesting to me to kind of go back and think on the other items that we have seen and what's actually changed. I mean, technology in general seems to speed up changes in every business over time, right? So the evolution of OWASP, I don't know if you want to talk about that, right? Yeah,
I mean, we can talk about that, but I think even just like, what are the two biggest vulnerabilities that AppSec is known for? XSS, SQL injection.
Yeah,
literally, like both of those vulnerabilities have become kind of mostly disinterested, or I don't know if I should say disinteresting, but like just or uninteresting, but like not really prevalent, right? And even still, like when you look at when we started this podcast, content security policy was like a very new thing. Not a lot of people were doing that, right? Now we've got, I mean, I think at that time too, I think like Angular was fairly popular, you know, and now becoming, I think Backbone and like their Ember and like a couple other client-side MVC frameworks were also competing at that time. But since we've done this podcast, you've seen tighter and, you know, less client-side frameworks, I think. I don't know, but it seems that way. With really, you know, it's a small portion of ways you can shoot yourself in the foot with XSS, right? And then you've seen like content security policy is like just a normal thing now. Everything from like, trying to think, like same origin, flags on cookies, and I don't know, man, it's just been like a lot of like different between sort of browser controls and just the adoption that's become less of an interesting or less of a, not to say it doesn't happen, but for sure it happens, but like just it's less of a thing. And then SQL injection is like, yeah, you can definitely mess it up for sure. That still exists. But like, how often do you actually come across a legit SQL injection that you can externally, you know, take over the app or exfiltrate all the data or become admin or whatever? How often does that really happen anymore?
Just not
that frequent. So ORMs.
And
so,
yeah.
the shape of what we're about, I feel like, has gotten more complex, right? Like, that's what I feel like. I feel like our concerns these days are, because of the frameworks doing what they do and because of things being the way they are and knowledge and all that, it's just, it's, there are plenty of vulnerabilities being introduced. They're just, I feel like in a lot of cases, a little bit more complex.
They're complex, and it's usually less impactful, right? From a severity perspective. I don't know. It's strange. If I think about my last month of testing and code review, like what we've actually identified, we had one client that we were working with. Actually, you know, Julian, if you remember, from Australia, like, you know, great guy. Like, he brought us down for AppSec Day, used to run that down there. But he, like, brought us in for it, you know, an assessment. And the code that we looked at, right, like, I will tell you, it was one of the most frustrating reviews that I've ever done, at least from an identification of vulnerabilities perspective. Right? And this is what I would expect out of a program being run by Julian, to be honest, right? Shout out to him. But man, like, I think he was in one of our first, you know, secure code review courses. And so, like, you know, it was like, oh, there might be an authorization flaw. Nope, it looks like that's already been taken care of. Oh, authorization. Nope, that's already been taken care of, right? Like, and like, we did find some niggly, like, configuration issues and other things. But, you know, banging your head against a wall and, yeah, being very, like, difficult to do. Like, the things that we were identifying are more, either items that you can talk about or layered security, right? Like, oh, this is a best practice. Those are the discussions that we're having. Logging issues, my favorite thing, right? Like, Crocs and Socks of logging, like, those always pop up. But they're still, like, edge casey type stuff, right? Like, it's not, hey, somebody can take over this vulnerability or this application. But then on the flip side, we had another one that we looked at that we actually found SQL injection in and could export, like, the whole database, right? Like, and that's all within the last month of what I've actually seen. Now, that, again, is uncommon. Like, that's the first time that we've had one that we could actually exploit that was, like, a full-on SQL injection in probably 2+ years, right? Like, you know, so it still does happen. But again, it was an older tech base. Probably something that didn't get as much scrutiny because it was protected or wrapped with a VPN to actually get in and utilize this application. So, you know, first time it probably had been assessed as in depth as we were going at it, right? So I guess where I'm going with that is, yes, it's changed, but it is still there. But I'm finding more and more that we're frustrated and we're talking about edge cases. We're talking about business logic flaws. We're talking about like the real security and the real threats of an application, as opposed to the skiddy type vulnerabilities, right? The XSS, the cross-site scripting, the stuff that was just, you know, overall fundamental flaws in how the application was designed. Now it is very much a focused threat analysis and focused vulnerability analysis that we're doing. And any of the guys on my team would tell you the same thing, right? We're spending a lot more time on that stuff that feels to be more impactful, but also harder to actually exploit.
Yeah. Applications are doing more complex things. But also, there's just more baked in. Doesn't mean, I mean, people shoot themselves in the foot all the freaking time. But yeah, I think that makes sense that it's getting harder for you, or not hard. Well, that the low-hanging fruit's not as prevalent, and then it takes, which is good, right? Like, that's, if I'm going to hire a human to do human work,
yeah,
I want the really, like, the stuff that machines are going to struggle with and that we really do require a very creative human to do. But so in some way, that's maybe a really positive thing because it allows you to spend less of your time looking at low-hanging fruit, validating it, writing it up, classifying it, just thinking about it in general. Whereas, yeah, you can spend more time on what matters, which can be good. I mean, I think you and I have talked about it. Consulting is interesting because it's definitely like everything's being impacted, but that's one where it's like definitely the business model will have to become more and more optimized, and you'll be really probably like digging in hardcore on just like what really, really matters, which I don't know, as having done that job, sign me up. I'd rather focus on what matters than write up how your cookie didn't have these two flags and how bad that is for your organization.
Trying to justify it. Yeah. Doing this.
Why am I doing this to you? Why am I doing this to me? Why is, yeah. Anyways.
Yeah. Maybe. Yep.
But it's been interesting, man. 300 episodes, just, and also like one thing that I think that people do say, and I think they get, is that, and just so you know, when you say this to Seth or I, we really love that, because when people come up to us and they say, well, hey man, like, wow, that's a lot of episodes, like way to be dedicated, way to be consistent. Yeah, thank you, because that is hard. It is hard, especially like, we're both running businesses. This is not easy to do. So when you say that to me, when you say it to Seth, it actually means a lot. It's like, thank you. Yeah, thank you for acknowledging that this requires some level of consistency. We always have to do some work to look up articles, scrap ones that don't make sense, make sure that we, also with AI being everywhere, it's actually like hard to, it feels almost harder now to curate content that is AppSec specific, but not just with AI driven on top of it. So trying to blend things together, it's just not an easy proposition always. So we love doing it, but thank you for those people who've noticed the consistency.
Yeah. And again, thanks for listening. Thanks for being a part of the community. Let us know if there's something that you would like us to revisit. Right. We are scheduling new guests as well. You know, it seems to ebb and flow there also, depending on how much time we have to interact. There are, you know, people that we would like to get back on the podcast. But if you have someone that you would like to suggest, please, you know, bring it up. Send us an email, jump in Slack, make an introduction. That's always of use to us. We like meeting new people. We like, yeah, just in general. Like, obviously, we like doing this on a weekly basis. Otherwise we wouldn't be 300 episodes in. But yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's it. Yeah.
If it sucked, but no, we appreciate everybody's participation and the community, and yeah, it's been great.
It's been great. And we will be doing, we got to figure out a giveaway, right? Like for 300 episodes, we'll be doing something. Ken and I just have not had time to coordinate over the last week or so to actually get that together. Surprise, surprise. But it is coming. So watch this space, watch our Slack and our social media if you would like to, you know, enter the drawing or whatever it is that the giveaway that we will be doing. Yep. Cool. Ken, any final thoughts? Before we close out today's episode.
Thanks for doing this with me for 300 episodes, and I hope we get another 300 more. So thank you. You, Seth, and to the listeners. Thank you to you for doing this with me.
No worries. Thank you. All right, everyone, sign up for training. And we will actually see you all within a week or two. Obviously, we will be back. This is not the end. Thanks all.